Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hello and welcome to the Publicly Challenged Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Oswald, and I hope you join me on my quest for knowledge to become a better public land hunter, angler, and forager. Stick with this and who knows, maybe we will learn something together. All right, real quick before we get started on the show, I'm just going to talk about Tree Line Academy. You've heard me say it. I can't even tell you how many times. Mark Livesay is treelineacademy.net. That's treelineacademy.net. Sign up. Use the promo code PC2020. Save yourself $20. Can't say it enough. It's awesome. Amazing. Most comprehensive e-scouting course out there. Check it out for yourself. Sign up. Use promo code PC2020. And now let's get to the show.
All right. So I'm sitting here and I am talking to, I'm going to say, Chef Alan Burgo. Alan, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good.
So could you do me a favor and kind of introduce yourself for everybody listening if they're not familiar with you? And if they're not, after this episode, I'm sure they're going to have to dig deeper and find all your cool stuff you got going. But can you introduce yourself for everybody listening?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Alan Burgo. I spent a good 15 years in the restaurant industry. And as I started working into nicer and nicer restaurants, I started to see that a lot of the food that I was working with, like the most interesting stuff and also like the most expensive stuff, is all wild. And I started to teach myself about it. Eventually, my restaurants closed. By that time, I had been supplying my restaurants with wild food. So I started to basically hunt mushrooms and plants and full time, which is a very abbreviated version of the story. I started a website about 8 or 9 years ago now. It's called foragerchef.com. That's how most people know me, from working with a lot of mushrooms, plants, and different types of game.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty modest introduction, but I'll kind of embellish on that a little bit. But There's people like Hank Shaw have often said they're excited and curious to see how far you'll take the culinary experience with foraged items. And it's pretty neat to see all the stuff you're always putting out, especially on social media, and because it's Instagram, you know, not as many words all the time, but a beautiful picture, and it really portrays and paints a beautiful scenery, the way you're plating things and coming up with interesting new dishes and takes on things that, quite frankly, I've never even seen on some of that. So it'll be pretty cool to do something a little bit different tonight. And you kind of suggested it as well, to talk about butchering animals and utilizing those different organs and pieces of meat. Can you kind of elaborate on that and kind of where that all came from versus, you know, just kind of talking about, you know, because most people don't really do that, I guess I should say. They don't utilize the entire animal. There's only certain cuts that they prefer. And then seems like the rest of it, they pretty much just grind up or they don't even utilize it all.
Yeah. So that's whole animal butchery. Like, this is how I was trained. Is what I was trained to do, especially when I was at Heartland, where the menu changed every single day. The whole animal came in, you know, and I would be running the tasting menus. I had two different courses on the meat tasting menu, first and second courses. And we would almost all the time, we would have some kind of rotating offal, whatever it is, just working through the different parts of the animal we had. And we use just about everything that you legally can in Minnesota. So that's how I was trained, and that's how I cook and eat at home too.
So when you're doing these cuts, like, can you give some examples of some of the stuff that you you utilize that normal folks, or I guess people that aren't conditioned to actually even processing their own animal, some of the things that you utilize and kind of like how you would utilize it?
Yeah, well, I'll say too that butchering your own stuff at home, it also can help you be more creative just with the regular cuts. And this isn't going to be true. Some of this won't be true with like venison, because so I was butchering sheep the other day. I actually had to butcher a pregnant ewe on Easter because of like birth problems. I felt like such a heathen. Yeah, a pregnant ewe on Easter. The timing was just terrible. But I took that opportunity to cut some new cuts that I'd been wanting to do. So I cut some Barnsley chops, which are two T-bones stuck together with the spine in the middle. It's a British cut. So butchery at home lets you do all kinds of different stuff that you won't get from a processor. It's a ton of work, but for me, it's totally worth it. As far as the offal, I don't think you have to save every single thing every single time. I don't, because, maybe I still have a liver in the freezer, or maybe I have something else that I need to use up. What I do is I have a couple different projects that I may be working on, and I'll take a few different things one time, a few things next time. But you can totally save everything too. And some people really like to do that. I think one of the things that people usually throw away that are really, really good, like, because you have like gamey organ meat, and then you have organ meat, I mean, at least to me, then you have organ meat that's a little bit easier to work with. Stuff that's easier to work with is like heart and tongue. Those are really easy to work with. Testicles. I do like testicles. I've probably eaten the most testicles out of anyone that I know. And kidneys, especially. I love those.
So when you're utilizing the kidney or even the testicles for that matter, how important is the preparation before the actual, the cooking of the meal for that piece of meat? I mean, it's gotta be.
It's super important. So I have a couple tricks, and these are really, really useful, almost like no matter what kind of organ meat you're cooking. Tongues and hearts, I think, are so mild personally that they don't need as much attention as something like testicles, especially if it's from a game animal. The lamb, goat, and sheep are pretty comparable to venison in that way. Testicles, I soak them. One of my tricks is brining. So I will brine anything and everything. Put it in some brine, just like how you'd soak liver in milk. You can soak it in brine. I will also like leech organ meats. Like if a liver is really strong, I'll cook a little piece up. I'll taste it. And if I think it's really strong, then I will actually just soak it in water with no salt for like a day or two. And then I'll change the water a few different times. And then I'll brine it after that. And that really tones down the flavor. I like to do that when I'm going to make liver dumplings and things like that. So brining, and then after brining, smoking. Like this is how to make the greatest testicles that you've ever had. Okay, you brine them, and then you smoke them after the brine. And they're so good. And you could even take them after they're cooked like that and bread them and fry them and do Rocky Mountain oysters. They're fantastic.
So when you're doing brining
is a big key.
So when you're doing those testicles and you're smoking them, is it like a long, low and slow type of smoke to where it actually makes the meat a little bit more tender, because the testicle itself is kind of tough, isn't it?
No, the testicle is really interesting. So it has the texture of a hot dog. Like by its nature, it has the texture of a hot dog, of like an emulsified sausage. That is the texture of a testicle. It's not wobbly. It's not jiggly like brains. It's firm, and it tastes like a hot dog. The texture is like, that's like exactly what it is. they really like to be soaked in brine And with the smoking, all you have to do is, after brining, you just cook them until they're 150 degrees Fahrenheit. You actually don't want to cook the testicles too long so they can dry out.
Okay, that's interesting. And when you're doing your brines, is it kind of like a traditional, salt type of brine, bring it to a boil and cool? Or what are you doing?
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. Salt, some spices, whatever I have. I'm not usually going to put like pickling spice. I'll probably do something really mild, or it might just be salt water. Like you can just dissolve salt in water and use that. And that will work in a pinch. Like boiling a brine with some herbs and spices and an onion and a carrot and a celery. That'll be great. And you'll taste it. You'll taste the difference. But just some salt water is totally fine too.
That's interesting. I've never, so out of animals, you're pretty much using domestics for that purpose for doing that? Or have you done it with wild game as well?
I've done it with deer too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's definitely nothing I've ever even considered saving other than for proof of sex when cutting up, processing up an animal, field dressing or quartering to take it out of the field. So maybe next time. Oh,
totally. The key is brining. If you don't brine them, it can be rough. Like beef and pork are pretty mild, but venison, goat, and a hogget, or, you know, like young sheep, they get pretty strong.
So I'm kind of curious, are you pairing that like as an appetizer, or are you making that into like an entree at that point?
Oh, it's like one slice.
Right.
But when I smoke them, I put that in front of people, and okay, depending on what I think they can take, I will tell them it's like a white kidney or a ham, or if they can really take it, then I'll tell them it's a testicle.
Interesting.
But people won't even know. They'll think it's ham. After you brine it and smoke it, it was a total game changer for me.
Wow. So if you're doing that and you're turning that into like, what would you accompany that with as far as a meal? I'm just trying to picture in my head, like, once
put it on a cheese plate.
Yeah.
Part of your charcuterie board.
So speaking of charcuterie boards, you do a little bit of work with some different companies for making your own type of dry aging type stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, Umai Dry is this company from the Twin Cities. It's family owned, and the guy that's basically running it now used to work in a hotel that I interviewed to run. So he's an industry guy, and they want people to be able to make charcuterie at home. And it makes it so easy that you don't need a curing chamber. You just vacuum seal some meat in this bag, make your sausage mix, put it in a bag, vacuum seal it, and then throw it in the fridge for 30 days. That's it.
That's pretty cool. Cause I know a few people that have tried it and ended up having, or building their own type of aging refrigerator for doing that. And the moisture content kind of got out of control and stuff didn't work right, and it molded. And so that's pretty interesting that you could just vacuum seal it in a bag and throw it in the freezer then for
sure. Yeah, it's idiot proof, because I've done stuff like that too. And I don't like wasting my time. You know, this, you can make any kind of charcuterie you want. Guanciale, pancetta, whole muscle cures, bresaola. They have little things for salami, anything. And they have bags that are big enough so you can dry age, like, you know, a whole subprime.
Yeah. So when you're making some charcuterie or something and you're going to put it in that bag, let's, for instance, say that you had some cuts or something left over from a deer, some venison from the year before or something like that, what would you be doing with that to make different, what cuts would you use and save for making sausages or whatever you're going to make and put in that bag and put it in the freezer or refrigerator?
Okay. So that's a great question, because stuff out of the leg in venison is so lean. That's great for making charcuterie, because the salami is never going to get cooked. So that's a perfect place to use those roasts out of the leg and stuff, you want to trim those. You want to make sure to get the silver skin off them, like totally clean them all. That's a perfect place to use those, like the shoulders and stuff like that. I save those because that's like my favorite part of the deer. I mean, besides you know, the traditional parts, because it's muscle that's hardworking. It's got a lot of marbling in it, and it's great for slow cooking. You know, if you slow cook a venison roast, you get a piece of dust. You know, it's okay, but it's not anything like slow roasting a shoulder or a shank or something like that when you have that intramuscular fat.
Right. Yeah. No, that's so, actually, I've got a couple actual whole front shoulders that I froze all the way down to the joint of the shank. And I've been thinking about trying to do something with those, but haven't really come up with anything special yet. But I want to try and utilize the entire leg in one dish.
Okay, well, here is a fantastic one for you. It is so good. It's an African technique. I edited a cookbook from Mali, okay? And this guy, Pierre Thong, he's a chef in the States now, but he's actually from Senegal. So no, it's a Senegalese, it's from his book. And in the village, people take big chunks of meat and they'll bring it to like the village oven and they wrap it in paper and they cook it in this slow oven all day long. And then when they get home, everybody gets a little piece of meat wrapped in paper. So what you do, I do this with so many things. If I have a big cut and I don't know what to do with it, I season it up. I season it up with whatever I want. I let it sit overnight and then I wrap that thing in parchment in like two layers. And I cook it at 250 for like, depending on how big it is, like 5 or 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's falling off the bone. It's so good. The beauty is that the parchment allows the meat inside to caramelize from the heat, but it still kind of steams it a little bit. So it's like steam roasting, but really, really low and slow.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. So when you talk about seasoning, you're the kind of guy that I don't see going and buying a bunch of commercial seasonings.
No.
But more so you're creating your own seasonings. Can you kind of just talk about some of the things that you would kind of use on cuts of meat after you process them and what those plants are that you're finding and kind of how you do that? Because I know you create some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I really love working with ramp leaves. So I make a lot of different stuff with ramp leaves. There's a ramp spice in my book that's really good. And I use that kind of just like all-purpose, just an all-purpose seasoning. Soups, ribs, meat, I put it on everything. But I really encourage people to kind of play around and experiment with stuff. With meat, I'm a sucker for like just old school, like Creole blackening spice. Like I grew up cooking in the early 2000s and Paul Prudhomme was the man. There was like two restaurants I worked at where we used that on everything. So a lot of times I'm probably doing a variation on that, especially for meat. So it's going to be paprika based. And then I'll probably add some other stuff to it. Which could be, you know, dried herbs from the garden, or I do one where I put a bunch of ramp leaves in that, but I may not use all wild stuff all the time. And I think that's totally fine. Another good one that I do is a mix with wild Szechuan peppercorn, so prickly ash, and I do like a 5 peppercorn mix, but with prickly ash in it. And then I just will like crust a whole steak in that. Only one side because it gets pretty intense. Or like pork tenderloin is really, really good. So then you have a bunch of different peppercorns, and then you got the one wild element, which is the wild Szechuan peppercorns, and all the heat together. It's like hot chilies, a little bit of coriander, black pepper, white pepper, Szechuan peppercorns, and you get the hot, you get the little bit of numb with it. Super good.
That sounds interesting. So one more time, what was the plant that a prickly
Prickly ash.
Prickly
ash. Yeah, Xanthoxylum americana.
And where does that kind of grow? Like what environment would that be in if somebody's trying to seek it out? Is it fairly common or is it?
Oh, it's super aggressive. It's like a weed up here. I don't think you guys have it like down if you're in the South. I know in the Midwest, it is absolutely everywhere.
That's interesting. I'm going to have to look into that one a little bit more for sure.
Yeah, it's a small shrub. It's a shrub. Grows into big colonies. They used to make like bitters out of it in like the Wild West. They'd have like prickly ash bitters back to like the 1800s. Toothache tree is another thing that people call it. But it's literally a cousin of Szechuan peppercorns. They're both in the genus Xanthoxylum.
That's interesting. So it definitely has a little bit more heat than your standard peppercorn then.
Well, there is actually no heat.
No,
it makes your mouth go numb.
Interesting. Okay. So
yes, in Chinese cooking, you have mala, and mala is like hot and numb combined. And when you taste it, when it hits your tongue, your mouth starts like water. It's like this insane watering when you have spicy and the numbing of the peppercorns together. It's kind of like, it's like indescribable. It's super addictive.
I've never heard of that either.
If you like spicy food, it's just like another like thing to put with spicy food. Oh, it's crazy.
That's interesting. So
super traditional.
I'm kind of curious, like what you're doing. You talked about kidneys. How are you preparing the kidneys? What are you doing beforehand to prepare them and kind of just like walk me through a dish?
Okay, so kidneys are, this is why kidneys are awesome. People think when they imagine eating kidneys, they think kidney on toast, or like you're going to eat something on a plate and it's just a kidney. That is not how I cook kidneys. I love all the old British recipes, like steak and kidney pie or Lancashire hot pot. So the way the kidneys are used there, I'll soak them overnight. I mean, they're a piss filter anyway. So I'll soak them in water. I'll soak them in brine, whatever I want to do. And then what you do is you cut them into pieces. Like you cut them into like nuggets, right? Like you'll like quarter them or cut them into eighths or dice. And then let's say I'm going to make steak and kidney pie. First, I'm going to take some bacon and I'm going to cook that down and get the fat out. Then I'm going to add the kidneys. Then I'll probably take that out and brown the meat and then put the kidneys and the bacon back in there. And then I'll add some other stuff. And at the end, they just kind of like mix in with everything else. And you can barely tell they're there, but they like, you cannot make steak and kidney pie without kidneys. And Lancashire hot pot should have it too. So it's like, they just kind of like melt into these rich, like thick, hearty stews. And that's my favorite way to have them. I don't really love deviled kidneys. I like brined and smoked kidneys. Those are good. But cooking them in soups and stew, like the beautiful thing compared to liver, kidneys don't overcook, right? You can't take liver and cook it for 2 hours and have it taste good. That's going to be crap, right? Kidneys are different. You can cook kidneys in a stew in the crock pot and they're going to be totally fine. They don't care.
So when you're cooking them and you say you can't overcook them, is it because the texture doesn't change at all either? Or it's just, how's that kind of come into play?
I mean, I don't know like the exact science of like why it is, but liver is just going to get super dry and tough, right? And kidneys don't, for whatever reason, they're totally fine. They're like a little piece of stew meat.
Interesting. Yeah, because I've never experienced a kidney, so I can't even speak to.
Oh, the steak and kidney pie with stew meat, bacon, and little cut up kidneys. Oh man, oh it's so good.
Really,
it's so good.
Yeah. Yep. So like I've cooked liver and mostly the traditional way, kind of just slicing it in the, and doing it in the pan with onions and mushrooms or something like that, but never really got into any kind of experimentation. So what's your take on like going forth with the liver and doing something a little bit different? Is it kind of the same process you're soaking?
Yeah, just don't overcook it.
Right?
Yeah, I'll probably soak it. And one thing that's important to know, like I'll probably take I'm not going to soak the whole liver. Okay. So I'm going to cut the liver into slices and then I'm going to soak it. And I'm going to soak it, depending on the size of that thing, I'm going to soak it in probably a pretty large container. Because if you put like a venison liver is reasonably sized, you know, if you put like that in a container where it's sitting really tight or it's in like a gallon bag, God forbid, with like 3 cups of milk or something, that's not going to do anything. So you got to make sure that there's enough water, you know, start with a gallon. You got to make sure there's enough water for those, you know, kind of think of them as like gamey solutes to disperse into. You got to give them somewhere to go. So the more liquid you soak your organ meats in, the more of that flavor is going to diffuse into the water for you to pour off.
That's interesting. I mean, it completely makes sense and it makes me want to try.
Yeah, I cut it into slices. You cut it into slices and it makes it that even faster because you're not soaking the whole liver. So
when you cut it in slices, are you like most likely just waiting a day instead of, like you said before, kind of letting it soak for multiple days?
I'll just wait a day and I'll cover it in milk. Milk and liver is a tried and true, you know, really classic combo.
Have you made a dish that it sticks out or stands out more than anything else that you've done with like the liver?
Oh yeah. Liver ravioli with caramelized onions and mushrooms.
Are you putting the liver?
Good Parmesan.
Are you putting liver inside of the ravioli then? Or
what? Yeah, you'll make it into a puree. You're not going to use a lot of liver like that, but it's really good.
So when you're doing the puree and you're putting it in there, I'm just kind of curious, are there other foraged items or anything or some type of green? Like, would you put in, for instance, let's say nettles or something in with that and put it into the pasta?
No. So, well, you could make green ones, but it'd be much cooler to have them be brown and then have some green nettles fresh tossed with the ravioli.
Okay.
You know, so the liver is like, basically you're putting liver mousse in ravioli, right? And then you just pick some little dance partners to go with it.
Nice.
Nettles would be perfectly fine.
Yeah.
So with mushrooms and brown butter and birch syrup.
So when you say that, what kind of mushrooms would you be putting in there? Is it just completely seasonal at the time or would it be?
Whatever. Chanterelles would be nice because they'd give you a pop of color.
Very nice. So do you guys have, let's kind of go into that real quick because I'm curious. I remember last year or last summer you posted something that you finally found a certain type of chanterelle that you hadn't ever really found before. Was it like a cinnamon one or something? Because normally you find goldens or what was the sought after?
The white chanterelles that I was picking a few years ago finally got published in a academic journal.
Okay, so you're saying that you knew they were chanterelles, but at the time it wasn't actually published yet.
We were trying to figure out if they I'm not a scientist. The mycologists were trying to figure out if the white chanterelles that I picked were a separate species or if they were like an atypical mutation. And it turns out that they were an atypical mutation. So they're basically golden chanterelles. They were basically an albino version of Chanterelles phosmatus, which is our local chanterelle here, and it's the best chanterelle in the world. And it would just grow completely white with kind of like a little yellow on the top. And basically what it is, it's not a separate species, but that is a characteristic that you will see in all kinds of chanterelles around the world. So they had pictures of all these different species with their like albino versions next to the real version. It was so cool. I had never heard of that. I've heard of different albino mushrooms though, and it makes a lot of sense because I get lobster mushrooms that are albino. I have friends on the West Coast that have picked albino black trumpets. And it seems like the albino, this atypical mutation, basically makes the flavor a little bit more mild and maybe give them a little bit more of a delicate texture in the case of the lobsters. But it kind of makes them more subtle, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what that was.
That completely blows my mind, though. I never knew that a mutation in mushrooms. I understand, like, what do they call when a lobster mushroom actually happens, it's another mushroom that gets infected with
Hypomyces.
Yeah, hypomyces. But I didn't know that So is it the hypomyces getting infected then, or mutating, I guess I should say, that's turning it into an albino?
I don't know.
They're like mutants.
Yeah, there's mutants.
You just blew my mind with that one because I've never heard of albino mushrooms.
Yep.
So when you're, I mean, it's got to be fairly common then, right? Like, because you're telling me all these different varieties that you've picked.
It's not common, but there are a couple places. I think I probably know like four people in Minnesota that have picked white, like albino shants.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's not common, but there people found them, you know.
Wow. So I guess we probably transition back into the butchering process. If somebody's wanting to kind of start doing that themselves, because I just know so many, especially hunters, they don't even process their own meat as far as breaking the animal down or utilizing the cuts. It's pretty much whatever the butcher gives them. Is there any kind of advice that you would give somebody if they're wanting to start out or start doing that?
I mean, deer is really easy. I mean, then I use a Sawzall, but all you're doing is basically cutting shanks off. It's so easy. Cut the shanks off, cut them into whatever sections you want. Oh, I cut ham steaks last year that were pretty fun. Venison ham steaks. Basically, you want to have a friend that's got a tripod if you want to butcher yourself or some kind of setup. I mean, I know plenty of people that do perfectly fine cutting deer up on cardboard in the garage. And I've done that, you know, so many times too. If they want to be more creative with it, I would say there's a number of things on my site that are pretty helpful. Hank, of course, you know, has like all kinds of stuff. I kind of only focus on more kind of off the beaten path things with venison or things that I just really, really like. But Hank's a fantastic resource as well.
So just to clarify, Alan's talking about Hank Shaw. So, in case anybody's wondering who Hank is, but I'm kind of curious though. I mean, like when I do it, I started quartering up deer now. I don't do it any other way. I don't hang the whole deer anymore because it's just more convenient, especially if I take it earlier in the season. I'm able to put the entire deer in a cooler with some ice underneath it and maybe some ice packs or something on top of it, just because I don't want the water running through it, even though I don't, according to a lot of people I've talked to, it doesn't actually hurt it, but I feel like it changes the meat a little bit. What would you think on something like that to where, you know, you got water running through the meat?
Okay, hold on. Refresh me here. Why is there water running through the meat?
If you put ice on top of it in a cooler.
Oh yeah, no, don't do that.
Yeah,
I mean, cold packs or something is fine, but I mean, if you got to take it and if you have to butcher it and it's like too warm to hang it, then just cut it up and be done with it, or hopefully figure out a way to leave some of the cuts in the fridge, like on a cookie sheet overnight. I have a 20 cubic foot fridge in my garage and a 40 cubic foot freezer, so I'm kind of spoiled. But you know, ideally you want the meat to dry out a little bit. It's just going to taste better.
Yeah, so the way I actually do it now is I'll put ice in the bottom of the cooler, but I have a tray that I put on top of the ice and then put the meat on that, so it's letting the blood actually drain out of it and not letting the water, and it's got legs on it.
Whatever works, as long as the meat's not in the bathtub.
Yeah. Well, so that's the way I do it now, and then I just take the quarters and work with them as I can, and break them down into individual muscle groups and start cooking with them, you know, or vacuum seal it and put it in the freezer. But I'm kind of curious, like, what's your favorite cut to work with on say venison?
Oh, shoulder or the neck?
Yeah. What are you doing with the neck then?
With the neck, I usually roll them and slow cook them and then chill them down, slice them into perfect pinwheels, and then I'll gently reheat them on both sides until they're like golden brown. That is like, that's a good eating right there. That is like one of my favorite cuts on whole deer.
So when you're rolling it out, are you just straight up rolling it up and cooking it, or are you pounding it out or tenderizing it? And then
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give it a good pound. I usually take the neck off depending on the size. I think there's been only one deer that I butchered where the neck was so big I had to cut it into two pieces. But most time I'll take it off, like just the whole, you know, stripe of the neck, all around the neck. I'll skin it and take it off in one piece, and then I'll pound it, or maybe cut it in half and make two smaller ones.
So you're going for more like a traditional roulade, or would it be?
You could call it a roulade. You could call it a roulada.
Yeah,
rouladen. Roll it up,
depending on where you're at, right?
But so
when you're rolling it up, what are you? I mean, I'm just kind of curious because the way your mind works versus mine, it's more or less. I look at a cookbook and try and come up with something. So, I mean, what are you putting in there? Like other meats or different cuts of the animal?
Just as little as possible.
So when you say, I'm just like, are you putting greens in there, making some type of cream, or realistically just...
No. Okay. So I'm going to pound the deer neck into a rectangle. I'm going to season it all over with salt and pepper. I'm going to put some fresh herbs, maybe like parsley, a little bit of thyme. If I want to get creative, and that could be just fine, just like herbs, and roll it up and tie it and go. That could be fine. You can sure stuff it with things too. I've done some with duck cell. I did a nice venison neck with totally stuffed with duck cell, and that's good. But there's nothing wrong with just putting some nice herbs on it and salt and pepper and rolling it up. A little bit of breadcrumbs is really nice. Or like another classic thing is just finely minced garlic and parsley. That's legit. And then just roll it up. If you put too much stuff in it, people have a tendency to try to put too much stuff in their stomachs and in roulades and things like that. So a really good one to start out with, you could put like a really thin slice of prosciutto or a thin slice of ham. That you could do. But if you start putting like, oh, is it cheese and mushrooms and spinach? No, get out of here with that. Don't do that. You just want as little as possible, and it's going to make it so it's harder for the stuff to fall out. Don't put vegetables inside of meat rolls. I can't stand that. Cook the vegetables and make them taste really nice and put them on the side. Because if you cook that venison neck in the oven for 4 hours, then you got to eat spinach in the center that is like ghost spinach, you know? But it's ancient spinach.
Stuff that's falling apart. Yeah, that's totally makes sense.
It's really clean.
Keep it clean and keep it simple. And then you're not detracting from the meat either. You're just enhancing it.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's a good process there. Because you mentioned the whole thing about like putting in some type of real thin meat or something. Is there any type of deli meats or anything that you've ever made out of venison that you liked or turned out really good?
Oh, absolutely. I just made some brisola, prickly ash brisola, and I actually used top sirloin. Top rack. And that worked really, really well. Also, biltong out of the top round.
So you take it and air dry it then?
Yes, the biltong. You cut it into like rectangles, and then they're like 1-inch rectangles. And you coat them with crushed coriander and black pepper. And then I vacuum seal and I put all these little squares into the fridge, and then they dry. And then basically you have like jerky planks, and you cut the jerky fresh off of the plank of biltong. It's so good.
Okay.
Because a lot of times jerky can be like eating tree bark, you know?
Correct.
And I like it like that. This is just a different version, and it's really cool. But the Prosciutto is flavored, that I did is flavored with prickly ash. That was really fun. I did some venison salami. Oh, I did a venison, dried venison chorizo with wild fennel seed. That was out of this world. That was really, really good.
So,
I do add pork to my venison salami.
Is it when you do that? Then is it like a certain ratio, or is it or a certain cut of pork? Is it pork fat, or is it?
I mean, it could honestly, it can be any pork fat. Some recipes will say you can only use back fat. I mean, just make sure you got some decent looking chunks, and it's not like all super stringy or something.
Is the
back fat is nice because it is easy to dice. It's kind of easy to work with. It's a nice, convenient shape. But really, like any fat will work in a pinch.
Is leaf fat the back fat, or is that a different?
No, leaf lard would be from the kidneys.
Okay, from the kidneys. So
this is also good. You could use that too.
Yeah, man, that sounds good too. There's so much out there that you can do. So I'm curious about the biltong though. When you said that you cut it up into squares, how thick were these squares?
About 1 inch.
So about 1 inch, and then how big? I mean, like 6 inches or 5 inches or whatever the piece is in a rectangle.
Yeah, I got a whole video on my YouTube too. Just that's super. It's super easy. You just cut it. You cut it into chunks. Thick chunks, and then rub it with salt, the mixture, curing salt mixture, and then coat it with black pepper and coriander. And that's, I vacuum seal it, then I take it out of the vacuum seal. The vacuum seal with the charcuterie is super, super useful. If you, let's say, you're going to make a whole muscle cure and you don't vacuum seal when you put the Instacure number 2 on, most of the time, I get like a gray ring around the meat. When you vacuum seal it, it forces the cure into the meat. So you get a perfect, even cure. It looks professional. You know, that's the best I can say.
Yeah. No, that's because I've experienced the gray ring around meat too. So that's.
Yep. You vacuum seal it with the cure. Leave it in there for like a week or 2 weeks, depending on the size of the cut. And that'll cure that.
Wow. Yeah, that's
yep.
And then you'll be
making fantastic charcuterie.
So when you vacuum seal it though, are you vacuum sealing it in the bag, the dry bag that dries it out, or are you just using?
Nope. This first, yeah. You got to penetrate it with the cure. So you're going to use. You don't want it to dry out. So you're going to use a regular vacuum bag, and then you can let it sit for however long you want. Like 2 weeks is like 2 weeks is usually pretty standard. But you could probably get away with less with the biltong and smaller cuts. You probably do like 4 or 5 days, then take them out. And then I seal them in the umai bag and then put them in the fridge and forget about them for set a reminder for the biltong's really quick. That's, I want to say that was like maybe a little bit less than 2 weeks. Bigger muscle cures at least like probably 6 weeks,
okay,
4 to 6 weeks.
That's interesting. That's neat. I like biltong. Never knew you could make it in your refrigerator. So that's definitely a cut. I'm going to have to try and play around with a little bit more for sure. What kind of wild stuff other than the Szechuan peppercorns and stuff like that would you be looking forward to add for seasonings and stuff like that for cuts of meat like that you're going to cure?
Seeds, wild seeds. So fennel is awesome. Wild fennel doesn't grow near me, but I love wild fennel so much. I ordered from this lady on Etsy, right? Szechuan peppercorns we went over. I mean, your dried alliums and stuff like that. Those are really good. Juniper, cedar cones. Okay. Cedar cones are like juniper, but they don't have thorns like some shrubs.
That's interesting. So do you grind, like when you take the juniper, are you drying it and grinding it into a powder?
The cedar cones, juniper berries, those you can just grind up. And those are fantastic, you know. The cedar cones, those I use fresh when they're green, and I grind them up into like a paste. And then I'll put that, like maybe I'll add some black pepper and some salt, make that garlic, make that into a paste, rub some meat, that vacuum seal it for a week. There's some curing salt in there. Take it out after a week. And then it's ready to go into the bag and dry age. But yeah, cedar cones are really good at game too.
I never heard of these.
Green cedar cones when they are young and tender. So like if you can smush it between your finger, it should be Eastern white cedar. The one that people use for ornamentals all over.
Yeah.
At least around here. Yeah, it's a great seasoning.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think the best thing that I make with it, okay, you take garlic cloves and crushed red pepper and rosemary and green cedar cones, and you mince it all together, and then you put it into a jar and cover it with olive oil. And you just like let that sit in the fridge for a couple days, or you can let it sit longer. And then you make a pan of like really, really good roasted or fried potatoes. And when the potatoes are like golden brown, like crispy, like tink, tink, tink with skins like a crackling, then you take a spoonful of that mixture and you toss the red hot potatoes in that aromatic mixture real quick off the heat, and then put them right into a serving dish. And it's like the most aromatic, like it's so good.
So man, that sounds great. I'm trying to picture because I can in my head right now smell the cedar and some of the other things, but what kind of taste does the cedar impart? Is it what you would think like when you smell it?
It tastes like juniper. It tastes similar to juniper.
Okay. That's an interesting profile for sure. But I'd imagine that would be good on potatoes. Like you said, that would be good. So one of the things that I've seen that I've always kind of wanted to ask you about is ketchups and some of the different things you've experimented with there, and some really, really old literature that I know you were digging into about ketchups.
Ketchups. I mean, yeah, you can make ketchup out of everything. I worked for a chef who used to serve peach ketchup with French fries. I mean, I wouldn't do that, but he did. With ketchup, catsup, I mean, the same thing. Basically, you know, before ketchup was made from tomatoes, it was made from all kinds of different things. And tomatoes are a new world crop, right? So ketchups are like the older sauces, and they could be made from, okay, you got ketchup made from green walnuts, ketchup made from mushrooms, of course, ketchup made from black walnut leaves, ketchup made from fruit. You know, maybe that's where people got the idea to make tomato ketchup, because tomatoes are a fruit, all kinds of stuff.
I just found it interesting, and I think there was one you made where it was like a liver ketchup or something.
Yes. Yes. That was a really old one. That was really, really fun. That was such a cool thing to do with liver. You take the liver and you basically like boil it with salt and water and spices. And then you clarify the finished, you add a lot of salt. So it's like, you know, 15% like soy sauce. And then you clarify the finished mixture with egg white, like you would a consomme.
Okay.
And then you decant the finished thing. It's like crystal clear orange. It's beautiful. And you use it like you would soy sauce, or you dash it on meat or something like that. Yeah, it was really interesting.
What kind of plate?
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating thing to do with liver.
Yeah. Because that was one of the things that just stuck out in my head. And since we were talking about liver, I kind of wanted to get your take on that. And And I mean, so it pretty much turned into a soy sauce, though. Is that kind of the?
Well, it's not soy sauce. Right. Like it's clear. It's in the same vein. You know, if you put it into a bowl and then like add a little bit of good tasting oil or something, it would be great to dip something in. Or you could add some to a bowl of rice, or you know, some noodles. Or something like that. That one I'm probably not going to like season like a soup with or something. It's because it was kind of precious, you know. Yeah. Like it didn't make like a huge jar, but it was really cool.
That's interesting. And when I just remember when you were doing that, I was like, man, that's something I have never heard of. And I remember you were digging obviously through some really really old books to try and find some of that stuff. So. It's kind of
yeah, I got a lot of those.
Yeah. So, I'm just kind of. You've mentioned some things, and you talked about your book and all that kind of stuff. So, can you kind of tell everybody? But before you do that, you've got a show on Taste Made right now. Can you kind of talk about that? I talked to you once before, and you kind of told me about filming. But now that that's wrapped up, you want to talk about you know, your show and where the people can find it, and then go into your book and flora and all that good stuff?
Yeah, sure. So there's my website. That's where most people know me from. That's foragerchef.com. I'm pretty active on Instagram. That's at foragerchef. And my book, The Forager Chef's Book of Flora, you can get wherever good books are sold. That's through Chelsea Green.
You got to talk about your show, man. Like you did.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So the Taste Made show. So yeah, that I made that with a certain kind of scatterbrained here. It's been a long day. I made that in 2020 with my friend who is a James Beard Award winning filmmaker. His name's Jesse Ressler, and that is streaming on Taste Made. So I think they had to do a different formatting with some of the episodes, but that's on Taste Made right now. I just went to this. I went to the search bar, and then I just went to series and typed in the word field, and it comes right up. The new name is Field Forest Feast. But yeah, it's nominated for a James Beard Award this year. So I'm super excited. I didn't think that we would have a chance because we filmed it 2020. So I thought the time had passed. Then there's another show that I can't tell you a ton about, but it should be coming out in like a month or two. We just finished doing recording, and that's me out in the wilderness, like basically alone by myself. And it gets kind of crazy.
That's cool though. Looking forward to that. It's always good talking to you, and it seems like every time I do, my mind is blown, and it's almost too much to process because it's my head's reeling with so many good things and wanting to get out and experiment and try all these things. So I always appreciate our conversations and talking to you. And thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem.
And once again, thank you so much for listening to the Publicly Challenged podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to. Also, if you could leave a review, that would help us out. And you can check us out on Instagram or at publiclychallenged.com. And once again, thank you so much for listening to the show.